So my name's Chris Helm. I'm the product manager for Windows Client Security. So anything that's in the Windows client, whether it's a desktop, the IoT phone, that all falls into my wheelhouse. And I focus on the integrity side of things. I have a peer, Heike Ritter, you probably heard of her. She covers active threat detection, so Windows Defender ATP. We'll talk about that here, of course, because I know that one as well, but she's really the SME on that one. And so today's session is about how we're going to defend basically the client against advanced threats that we're facing. So it's very focused on the malware and hacking space. And we're going to kind of carry the conversation through the, here's the threat landscape, these are the types of things we're thinking about, and then we'll just kind of move up the stack from power on all the way to the post-breach scenario. So we'll just kind of walk logically through the flow there. So many of you in the room have heard or maybe even seen this slide before, so I'm not going to belabor some of these early pitch things, but you know how difficult the situation is out there. Organizations realize that you know, cyber threats are a material risk to their existence. We can look around the last year and we can see some pretty amazing thefts of money, right? We heard about the Bangladesh bank. We've heard about what happened in Russia with the ATMs, where in hours they're able to hit thousands and thousands of ATMs and just pull money out of them. So, you know, this hits the bottom line, and so they're paying attention for good reason. And, you know, the boards of these organizations who are thinking about this, they realize that something that's very true, you understand this as well, is that organizations like yours really live in kind of a breach at will state. And so what does that mean? That means if organization targets you and they want to breach your organization, they're going to get in, right? I mean, you may be able to delay it, you may be able to detect it, but this idea that you actually have defenses that can keep invaders out of your network, that's an unrealistic thought because the adversaries have better weapons than we've had in the platform and even in the third-party space until I think Windows 10. That's where the things started to change, where I think we're starting to gain the advantage again. The reason why they've had the advantage for a long time, of course, is the actors are very different, right? We have organized crime, of course, but now nation-state actors are going after not just Lockheed Martin and these big defense organizations and government, they're going after small businesses as well. Sometimes attacking a small business gives you insights to get information to breach into a larger organization. And so, and then of course, we have, you know, ransomware is the new threat. Everybody's talking about that. How are we gonna solve that problem? That's a really difficult problem to solve, right? How do you detect a piece of software that's been maybe invited into your PC by a user clicking on something that's encrypting data versus something like BitLocker that's encrypting data or some other thing? Like, how do you know that that's a good or a bad thing? It's very difficult, and so that's a huge problem, and we have some solutions, luckily, we'll talk about today. But enough of the pitch. Let's kind of talk about the kill chain very quickly. The way all these attacks are very much the same, there's the entrance phase of the attack where you receive a malicious document, a link, it lures you to a website, and you click on a malicious code that exploits a vulnerability on an unpatched version of Java or maybe a zero-day in the browser, et cetera. And then, of course, from there, then the goal is to establish kind of a beachhead on the endpoint, steal credentials, and then you move laterally, of course, and expand from the endpoint to other endpoints, and, of course, then you get to your end-game goal. This is the sequence that happens again and again. Lots of people frame it differently, but we kind of like this 4 E's model, as you see here, the entrance, establish, expand, and end-game. And so here's just a very simple attack happened on NATO, and some of these attacks are so routine. Everybody talks about how sophisticated these attacks are, and in some respects they are, but it's really the orchestration of the attack that's sophisticated. Exploiting vulnerabilities sometimes sophisticated, but in many respects, it's kind of routine. If you find the vulnerability, you can use, you know, one of 24 patterns to exploit the vulnerability. So it is fairly routine once you find the vulnerability. Finding them can be difficult. But, you know, in this case here, somebody inside of NATO received a piece of email from another user whose device had been owned earlier. So this email came from an authentic user, you know, a person they know, they received the email, they clicked on a link that doesn't look suspicious at all, and it's based on some news that obviously this person probably knew a little bit about today, so of course they want to learn more about it. And of course, behind the scenes, what's happening? Well, there's a zero day that's being exploited, or maybe an unpatched vuln, runs some exploit code owns the browser, escapes the sandbox, now they own the host, and the user, of course, doesn't see this because it's all less than a second that they arrive on the page they think they're going to, and then, of course, the PC got silently owned in the background. So this happens again and again and again and again, and so we really have to to get to change our approach to solving this problem. And so here's a couple of news stories. I'm going to just kind of pass through these very quickly because I think this type of audience has kind of seen and heard of these. But credentials are obviously a problem. Pass a hash is what we're referring to here. Pass a hash is like your number one priority in your organization. If you know what that attack is, or if you don't know what that attack is, you should prioritize the solution, which is Credential Guard, which we're not going to really talk about here today. That should be really the first thing you deploy with Windows 10 because it basically blocks pass a hash. And then, of course, zero days are a huge, huge problem. And, of course, I love this quote. This came from the NSA. This guy's job is just to get zero days. So he's just buying these things from the black market. He wants as many of them as he can, and he probably has quite a few because they're very cheap to buy. You see that price, $95,000. You know, if you're a nation state, would you spend $95,000 to break into an organization? Absolutely. That's like chump change to these people. And it's even chump change to organized crime, especially when you're monetizing the millions. So at any rate, these are all problems, things you understand, and so let's get a little closer to the technology. So when we think about security, this is our model. We divide into pre-breach defense, that's really my focus, and then there's the post-breach stuff that we'll talk about as well, but the Heike Ritter owns. And so we'll just kind of just go from left to right. We'll start with device integrity, then talk about threat resistance. We'll skip identity information because that's out of scope for this, and then we'll finish with the post-breach defenses. And so let's drill into this area. So before we get into the tech, here's something that we've started to realize at Microsoft is super important for you. You know, Windows as a Service is a wonderful thing, but we always thought about it as a great way to deliver new technology to information workers so that they can be more productive. But actually, Windows as a Service is actually a security feature, believe it or not, right? And why is that? Well, the world you're used to is a world of brand new releases of Windows 7 or Windows coming out. So let's imagine that's XP first, then we got Vista, and then we had 7, and then eventually 8. And those came out on some cadence of like 3 to 5 years. And the day we shipped that product, its security capability did not get any better, right? But who did get better? Your adversaries. They went out and they created new techniques that the platform was not designed to mitigate, right? And so what happens? Well, what happens is they develop a gap of protection, right? They are actually more capable of defeating the system than the system is to defend itself against, you know, well-funded adversaries. And so you fill that gap with a bunch of third-party stuff that has some impact but probably doesn't solve the problem, as we all know, because every organization is constantly reporting it's been breached. And so the model of shipping new technology, at least from a security perspective, on a 3-year basis, it's just not tenable from a security standpoint. We have to be faster. We want to give our people productivity, but maybe more importantly, we want to give them new security capability rapidly. And so what does Windows Service do? Current Branch for Business gives you new security technology to deal with new threats and the threats that maybe we see coming that haven't been realized yet. And so we can follow the line of the adversary's advancement. So if you're a person who's thinking about LTSB, which is the long-term servicing branch that doesn't change for a number of years, you could think about that for certain devices. But if you have information worker devices or connecting to the internet, that's the wrong platform for those users. You really should be doing CBB, and I think it's pretty clear on why. Security is one of the major value propositions when it comes to Windows as a Service. So let's start getting to the technology side of things. And so in the ideal world, as you connect to the internet, which is where all these threats generally come from, not all of them, we want to have a line of defenses that get in the way of those threats, that keep your PC away from harm. That's our first goal. Then we have defenses on the platform itself. So we'll start with some of these things that are out there on the front lines, and then we'll talk about the things that are kind of more on the interior, like Edge and Device Guard, et cetera. So let's talk about protecting from the Edge. So Smart Screen really is an unsung hero. And what does Smart Screen do? Smart Screen is when you connect to the internet, and using Microsoft Edge as an example, it's going to prevent you from going to well-known malicious websites. Right, so that's a feature. We're all kind of familiar with this technology, but don't underestimate the power of this. This blocks, all by itself, about 97% of the threats that are out there, based on our information, are just blocked right away from this, right? Sadly, there's a lot left. Those 3% are pretty dangerous, but most of the threats are being blocked by this feature alone. So it is something people don't think about that's doing quite a bit of work. And then, of course, when you're, you know, that's one vector of attack, the browser. The other vector, of course, is your inbox. So Exchange Online is going to prevent all of these malicious links coming through email to land on the endpoint, malicious binaries. And so it does a great job there. And so the ideal world is your PC never even encounters threats because they're being blocked before the device encounters them. And so that's the ideal. But some, of course, get through. And so we have to also protect from within. And so the first stop here is device integrity. When we built Windows 8, and a lot of this work really started there, We really needed to deal with the threat where an attacker would be able to install malware. Maybe they would use a vulnerability. They get some malicious code on the endpoint, and then the first thing they want to do is obviously run their code, but the first thing they're thinking about is, I need to persist the next reboot, right? I need to be able to evade all the defenses on the PC, because if I can't do that, then I'm gone in an instant. And so what they do is they use what we call boot kits, and they try to install malware under the PC itself. So when you turn on the power button, there's a bunch of option ROMs that initialize. These are firmware components for your video card, for your BIOS. Ideally, the attacker can embed malicious code in there and get it to persist in there. If they can, they are really rooted into the system. It'd be very hard for Windows and antivirus and things running on top of the system to detect this persistent piece of software, because it's under the system. And if you can get under the system, there's likelihood that you can hide from it. If you can't embed yourself in firmware components, then what you want to do is you want to tamper with the master boot record and redirect it from starting Windows or Linux, and you want it to start the malicious code first, and then the malicious code then starts Windows under its control, right? So both those are considered boot kits. And so with Windows 8, we worked with Intel and another number of other partners, and we came up with UEFI, which is a modern BIOS replacement. BIOS is 30 years old, by the way. Thank God it's finally going away, and UEFI is the modern replacement for it. The beauty of UEFI is that it has a secure boot feature. When you turn on that PC, all those option ROMs, the firmware doesn't start if it's A, not signed, and B, it has to be signed by a trusted authority, so that's good news. No boot kits hopefully running in firmware anymore. And then, of course, the first code that's going to start is not going to be malware. It's going to be a signed piece of software, something hopefully from us, from Microsoft, and the UEFI component validates the signature and checks it versus actually a database of trusted signers, right? So this is good news. When you turn on the power button, you know Windows is starting first, or maybe it's Linux if you're starting Linux on it. And so UEFI Secure Boot with Windows 8 was really one of the best security features that we delivered, at least in that release. And then, of course, we have the TPM itself, which is also used. So UEFI represents a root of trust for us, but TPM is also another root of trust. And what we use TPM for today, we use it for BitLocker primarily, but now with Windows 10, we're using it across all sorts of things for identity, et cetera. But what we're using it for when it comes to integrity is the TPM can take integrity measurements of all the firmware components, so those option ROMs, we can actually measure those, create basically hash values that represent those unique instances of them. And the TPM can take those, and then we can sign them and seal them in a package, and then later on we can take a look at those. At the end of the presentation, we're going to talk about how. But imagine the TPM as being a component that can help us verify that this secure boot feature actually did what it said it could do. And here's the problem with UEFI Secure Boot. If Microsoft's signings process gets compromised by a nation state or a very sophisticated organized crime organization, if they can compromise our signing process, they can sign code, and they can install that in firmware components, and they can install that on the PC, and they can get UEFI to think everything's good, right? Because that whole system is based on the fact that the signing processes have not been compromised. If they have, all bets are off with these features. But TPM measurements give us an opportunity to detect that type of thing. And so if you're familiar with Stuxnet, Flame, which is, these are things from nation states, TPM and measured boot give us an opportunity to detect those type of threats rather than live with them for years on end. So let's move on from the boot integrity to the platform integrity. And the next thing so that starts is once Windows starts clean, we know that's signed software, it hasn't been tampered with, it's the winload.exe, it's our bootloader. The first piece of code that starts is something called Windows Trusted Boot. Windows Trusted Boot makes sure that after we boot, everything that starts all the way up to Windows logon roughly, so all the device drivers, first party, third party, and even the antivirus driver, which is a new thing starting with Windows 8, we have a driver that runs in the boot process. We can do initial vetting even with AV and make sure that your AV can start with integrity as well. So in theory, rootkits. So rootkits start before Windows, rootkits start within the Windows boot process. This is a strong mitigation against rootkits. If somebody does tamper with one of these files, Windows will detect it and back it out and put a fresh, clean copy on it. So if you're running, the PC gets rooted, it requires a reboot for that to actually impact the PC, because it's not loaded in memory until a reboot. When the PC reboots, Trusted Boot checks everything again. It'll say, hey, that binary is malicious, and it will punt it out and bring a fresh copy in from a secure store that we have on the endpoint. From there, things get a little more interesting. And this is where our Windows 10 story, a lot of this is kind of Windows 8 stuff we've talked about. Now we're going to start talking about some new stuff. Windows 10 is really, I don't want to say it's all about isolation, but it's all about isolation, right? So when we think about how we're going to address modern threats, right? if we depend on the old tactic of just putting more defenses on top of Windows that hope that we can defend the platform, it's just not gonna work, right? We need to start isolating pieces of Windows from itself, and we also need to isolate applications away from Windows and your data. So with Windows 10, we started the journey of isolation, and we have worked extensively with Intel to make this happen. So they basically moved some extensions that were in their highest end processors, and those are starting to become pervasive in some of the processors that you're running. So vPro still has a huge value proposition to you, but if you're not running vPro, especially in the BYOD scenario, you have some pretty sophisticated technology that can allow us to do some really interesting things with containers and virtualization. So let's drill into why we need that. So if we think about the browser, The browser is one of the number one entry points into the PC. A lot of people say it's the inbox, and that's often true, but the inbox oftentimes leads the browser to actually exploit you, right? It's a link that gets you to open the browser, and then you get owned. Now, the good news is we're doing a pretty good job compared to the competition when it comes to vulnerabilities. So Edge is a really secure browser, more secure, at least in terms of vulnerability, than the competition, but it's still getting owned. That's still a lot of vulnerabilities, right? And the system can be impacted. So we need to think about that. We need a defense against the reality that there are going to be vulnerabilities and there will be exploits. We can't just stop there and say, oh, we've got fewer vulnerabilities of competition, so use us. It needs to be better than that. Here's another problem we need to think about. Kernel mode exploits. So Edge browser would be a user mode exploit. It's pretty bad because you own all the user data. So that's devastating, but if you find a vulnerability in the kernel, then you compromise everything. There's really no defense against that because you own everything on the PC. There's no software running on top of it from first or third party who can defend themselves against somebody who has kernel mode privilege. And guess what we see? We see attackers going increasingly after that. That doesn't mean we have more vulnerabilities in this space, but we see increased interest in this, and it's no surprise because they can get the most level of control, and because we're raising the bar of security in user mode, they're needing to look for other places. And so we need to deal with the reality that there are going to be vulnerabilities in the kernel. They're increasingly going after it. And so we have to have a defense, which we're going to talk about here in a minute. So what's the fundamental problem with desktop operating systems and even mobile operating systems? Well, they have a stack that looks like this. You have a kernel that runs platform services. And then if you're talking about mobile, like Windows Phone or Android or iOS, then you've got another layer in there, a sandbox that separates the apps from the platform. And that's good news. That really reduces the amount of surface area contact between apps and the system, and that provides a lot of value there. And then, of course, you have the apps that run on top of it. But on the desktop, in general, you don't have a sandbox. You do if you're using Windows Universal Apps, right? But most of the apps we use are still Win32, right? And they're going to be vulnerabilities. And so the challenge here is if there's a vulnerability in the app, they're going to get user mode control. They're going to be running as you. And if you're a really tight organization, then that's standard user, right? But guess what? It's still a disaster because standard user gives the attacker what? The ability to move across the network as that user account, right? It gives them access to all the data. It gives them access to all the apps that are running. So it makes it hard to install malware maybe, but it's still a problem even when you're running standard user. And if the user's running as admin like so many of us are, then you own the whole box, and there's no real good defense against that. And so what we need to do is we need to create the condition where vulnerabilities at the app layer can no longer give the attacker the level of control that they desire, which is control outside of the app across your system. And so the way we do that is through virtualization-based security. We released this in the original version of Windows 10. We had what we call a system container. This is a container that is isolated using hardware. So we're going to use like Intel extensions like VT-D and X and all these other things to create basically a virtualized machine, right? A virtual machine running in parallel with Windows. And we're going to take some of the parts of Windows and we're going to move it inside that virtual machine. And if the kernel of Windows gets compromised, it's a really bad data or a bad day for everything that's going on that side. So your user data is at risk. But at least the things we've moved into this environment, like your credentials, those are secure, right? So we're going to keep on moving more and more parts of Windows into the system container. Probably not everything, but all the things that make sense, things that are related to system defense, identity, and some of those things are going to be moved over there. And what we can say is we can't promise you there will never be a breach from the left-hand side to the system container, right? In fact, I can come up with some ways that that could happen. But what I can tell you is the surface area of attack is so small compared to where we were, those attacks will come far fewer and far between. And that's just because we've reduced the surface area to what will feel like a million miles versus a couple miles now. So anyway, so this is a huge, huge thing. Features like Credential Guard device guard, virtual TPM. We do secure biometrics in that container so people can't mess with that stuff. So this is good news. So let's talk about the future. Oh, actually, there's one more defense that I wanted to actually drill in. One of the most important defenses that we have comes with device guard. Device guard is really two features. We'll talk about them in more detail later. But one part of it is a code integrity service that runs in this system container. And what this does is it enforces a couple things. It enforces that all the code that's running in the kernel has to be signed and reviewed by Microsoft. So no random third-party drivers are going to be able to get in that space. It has to come to us. We review it, and we make sure that that's done correctly, right? So, and what does that done correctly mean? Well, it means that it's compiled with all the latest Visual Studio security flags, right? It means that ALSR is turned on. It means that DEP is turned on. It means that Control Flow Guard is turned on. We'll talk a little more about that in a little bit. But the code that's running in that space is running the latest and greatest. It's been compiled correctly. We've reviewed the code. And here's one thing that it also does. It also makes sure that the developer can't write sloppy code in this way. So the way a vulnerability exploit works is a developer writes, let's say, a device driver, and when they create the device driver and Windows initializes it, it's going to spin it up in memory, and it gets the memory address range is marked as writable, okay? So it's marked as writable, and then the image of the binary is laid into that writable space. And then ideally what happens next is the author then says, okay, these parts here are for read only, or are readable, meaning they can only be read, they can't be written to, and these parts here are executable. Okay, so if I do those two things, right, I've kind of partitioned my stuff out and I've added some security, but here's the mistake the developers make. They often fail to remove the write flag. And if it's writable and readable, what does that mean? That means an attacker who finds a vulnerability in the driver can insert more code into this readable space, and now the application is going to read that memory, probably causing it to fault and give the attacker control. If it's executable, which is an even better story, the attacker can write into the executable space, and then when that function runs, it's going to execute, right? So we make sure that there's never code that is left in both a writable and readable state and a writable and executable state, and this is how people are exploiting vulnerabilities in user mode and kernel mode, and when we turn all the flags on and we make sure we don't have sloppy code as far as how memory is arranged from a read-only and execute-only perspective, we can really reduce the number of vulnerabilities that can be exploited on a system. So that's what code integrity does for the kernel. So think about your kernel being hardened unlike anything you've ever had on a device maybe before. Knox has some stuff similar to this. So I'd say maybe they have something that's more on par. I'm not sure of other platforms having anything quite like this. This is, we think, something that we're doing somewhat unique. But things change quickly in this space, so don't quote me as saying nobody else has got it except for Knox and us. But then here's the future, right? Well, what happens if we take all of our apps and we don't run them on top of Windows anymore? What if they're all running in a virtual environment? What would that mean? Well, that would mean if there's a vulnerability in the app, right, I can, in theory, never get to the system unless I can find a way to compromise a hypervisor and move laterally across to the main platform and maybe even the system container, right? And again, surface area there is pretty small. Hypervisor is a pretty small piece of code. Another attack vector that somebody can have, so the hypervisor is one, but again, it's super small. The other attack vector is firmware components themselves. If somebody can put malicious firmware on an endpoint, you know, not all of them are option ROMs, right? We know that UEFI Secure Boot is going to make sure that option ROM firmware is all signed, but you know what? There's other firmware components on things that don't have that type of capability that UEFI Secure Boot doesn't protect. Firmware on a hard disk, for instance. If I get if the NSA installs malicious firmware on a hard drive and puts it on my PC, we don't have a defense against that, right? That is too low level in the stack. So firmware components are still a risk. The good news is there's not a lot of firmware code, so it's a limited area surface attack. It's a totally different type of a set of attackers that are going to be going after that. They're going to be very careful about burning their 0 days in that space, because when they do, people find out, and then we shut that down pretty quickly. But anyway, I just want to be super transparent. This is the future. This isolation will have, you're going to move up the hockey stick off the blade in terms of protection. It's not a promise. We're not unbreakable. We're going to see hacks, but they're not going to be as many as we're used to. So virtualization-based security is the way. And we'll talk more about the app story here in a little bit. So we've got all these great things. We've got UEFI Secure Boot. We've got isolation. That's all sounding really good. But we also need the ability to validate the integrity of the PC. A PC that gets deeply infected by something cannot self-report, or you can't trust a PC that's been infected, right? Because if the malware is going to say, hey, everything's good, your firewall's up, and your antivirus is all up to date with the latest signatures. It's going to lie to the system, and you're not going to know. And so what we need is the ability to remotely attest to the integrity of PCs, right? A PC can't do it on its own. It's not trustworthy enough. But imagine having a remote resource that's able to validate a PC. That's something that we'll talk about at the end of the presentation, but I thought it kind of fit in the context of this integrity conversation. So remote attestation, remote verification of PCs, and the ability to prevent unhealthy PCs from connecting to resources through email or your VPN, et cetera. That is something you got to prioritize. You got to keep these unhealthy devices off your networks. That's got to be something that you prioritize moving forward. So let's talk about, get a little bit nerdy, let's talk about vulnerability mitigations, right? So we've talked quite a bit about vulnerabilities. We haven't really talked about many defenses. We talked a little bit. We talked about code integrity. That's one of them. But let's talk about the things that more in user mode, like ALSR and DAP. So with Windows, we've added over time a huge volume of new mitigations. We added DAP, and then we added ALSR, and then we went to version 2 of that. I think the biggest, most recent innovation is something called Control Flow Guard. So ALSR, so DAP basically allows the developer to say, hey, these are the read-only parts of my memory. These are the execute-only, as we kind of talked about earlier. And then the processor from Intel, of course, enforces it. And so it's hard to inject code into memory. It's not impossible. It's harder to do it because you basically said a lot of stuff is read-only or execute-only, not writable. But ALSR is another defense, and what that does is attackers, when they find a vulnerability, what they need to do is they need to know where to insert their malicious code, right? And that means they need to understand the layout of memory, right? They need to know where functions are beginning and ending, and that's hard to do if you randomize it, right? And so what does ALSR do is it randomizes the memory, so if somebody finds a vulnerability, the likelihood that they'll know where the functions begin and end, because they want to overwrite one of those. They don't want to put it in the middle, because then they'll just crash the application. Then you know exactly where to write that code. ALSR makes that really hard. With Windows 8, we went to ALSR version 2, and what that basically was us taking advantage of 64-bit memory addresses. So we actually now, rather than a 32-bit memory address, which is that big, we now have a gigantic area of memory that we can randomize it, so it's spread out all over the memory rather than this really constrained space. So that makes it more random in a larger space. And then we went from roughly, I don't remember what the exact number was. It was like 8 bits of entropy. Entropy being, you know, the level of randomization, you might say. And we went all the way up to 32 bits. So if you do the math in there, that's a lot more random, a lot less predictable. So that's something that we've done with ALSR. But now the attackers are going, okay, well, it's really hard for me to heap spray and just inject a lot of code all over the place and find a way to get my code to actually run. And so what they've now done is a new technique. And so what they've done is they use something called a ROPTAC, a return-oriented programming attack, where they find a vulnerability, they inject some code in there, and it's kind of complicated because, of course, we have ALSR, but there are ways for them to find out where things are still. Even with ALSR, they can still predict where some things are in memory because sometimes applications actually inadvertently disclose where things are. So we call those accidental disclosures. Attackers can find these disclosures, and then they can find out where things are in this theoretically randomized memory. Well, it's not theoretically, it is randomized, but now they know where it is in random memory. And then they can find the pointers between functions, and they can, like, relink those functions. So imagine if I took a function, and rather than pointing to another Microsoft function in the app, imagine if I inserted some code somewhere over here in this giant memory range, and I redirected the function to point to that. Right, and so that is what a ROP attack is basically, and ROP attacks are kind of the new thing. That's what people are doing, and Control Flow Guard is a new tactic against that. What Control Flow Guard does is when the developer compiles their code, they turn on this new flag in Visual Studio, and then we actually hard code the wiring between functions. So an attacker cannot rewire a function to point to its own code. Everything is kind of hard linked and protected. So ROP attack is strongly mitigated with this new Control Flow Guard feature, which is paying huge dividends because what we found is a lot of the attacks all went to ROP, particularly in the browser. ROP attack is like the kind of standard go-to mechanism, and Control Flow Guard in IE mitigates that pretty strongly. So let's talk a little bit about App Container. So here's the stack we talked about. We talked about on iOS and Android and Windows Phone that they put a little layer between apps and the platform services that create a sandbox. We have that on Windows 10 as well, but not every app is universal app. Only universal apps get that sandboxing technology. All your Win32 still have direct access to the platform. meaning a vulnerability allows them to go directly to the platform, whereas a vulnerability in a universal app gives them direct access to the sandbox, but now they have to find a vulnerability there to escape it. So sandboxing is great in that regard, and here's a kind of an image on how that looks. Win32, vulnerabilities there, still a big problem, direct access to platform services using the user's credentials, and then a universal app really requires them to find two vulnerabilities, one in the app itself and then another in the sandbox before they can get access. So that's proving to be very, very beneficial, particularly in IE, and I'll show you some stats here in a bit. Now, when we think about moving from one version of Windows to the next version, the first thing people think about is app compatibility, and they're very scared about that. The good news is when it comes to information worker apps, we've got great app compatibility. We have great app compatibility because we kind of paid the price of app compatibility when we moved from XP to 7. With Vista, we purposely had to break the platform to make it secure again, right? So we had to break a lot of APIs that resulted in the app compatibility challenges that you faced when you went from XP to 7. We had no choice but to do it, and we worked as hard as we could with partners out there to update their drivers, to use the new models, and Vista paid a big price really because of this thing that we just didn't really have a choice to do. But once the app was worked on Vista, it also worked on 7, and our app compatibility continued to be good. And if it worked on 7, it also worked on 8. If it works on 8, it works on 10. So really, we're in this place now. We're not having to change things under the hood the way we had to in the past. And for that reason, we have really very, very good app compatibility in all areas except for one, and that is security software. Security software oftentimes has to get under Windows if it wants to be most effective. If you're running on top of Windows, you don't have the level of optics you'd like. So a lot of people build what effectively is a good boot kit, something that's running under Windows that's legitimate, maybe from McAfee or Sophos or whatever, Symantec, and they run under Windows. And sometimes even on Windows, they'll install kernel mode drivers that directly go into memory, meaning they don't use our APIs, they do all sorts of black magic stuff, and we have no idea what they're doing, and they're doing completely things we wouldn't recommend they do, but they provide security value, and so app compatibility with these third-party software products, very, very difficult to maintain, because they're not even using our APIs in a lot of cases. So what we did is we sat down with all the security vendors, said, hey, we have to stop the madness, we need to make sure that you can have app compatibility, and so they said, hey, you don't give us the APIs that we want. We said, hey, what if we instead, because we can't predict what API you want, you're always gonna come up with a new request every week saying, go give me something that does this. We said, hey, what if we gave you basically direct access to events running at the kernel level? We'll treat those events as APIs effectively, but it's just event data with metadata. We won't ever change the schema of those events. You could depend on those as if they were an API. And so we basically gave them this low-level access to all the kernel mode events, meaning everything that's going on the system, and they could then party on those things without installing drivers and poking around in memory and doing all this black magic stuff. So we gave this event channel out to them with Windows 10 initial release, and over the last year, they've been adapting their platforms to take advantage of this channel. So what does this mean? This means when you get the new version of McAfee that's using the secure event channel, that is gonna be great from an app compatibility standpoint because it's using something that we're not gonna change and they're no longer off the rails on how they're doing things. So good news for app compatibility for security software, which is a first. So let's move into the interior windows, kind of talk more about protecting within. And as you know, the browser is one of the most attacked surface areas. It's really one of the easiest ways for people to get into the system. There's lots of other vectors of attack. There's malicious documents that come in and open up in Office products. That's another vector of attack. That's something we're seeing a lot of people focusing on, but they continue to focus on Microsoft Edge. And whether Edge is a majority of the attacks or it's documents, like, I don't know. I tried to get some stats from our team, and they just were not really sure. But what we can say is a vast percentage, maybe not a majority, but maybe it's 49.9%, are coming through a browser, not necessarily Edge. In fact, maybe not so much Edge, as we'll talk about. But they're using a browser as an entry point in the PC because, of course, it's the connection to the internet and all this toxic stuff that's out there. So with Edge, we've really been focusing on wanting to make it the most secure browser, and we have a long list of things to make it more secure. We've got Smart Screen, we've got Windows Hello, which is new credentials. You're no longer having to use passwords all the time. A bunch of other things that make the web pages themselves more secure. We've got the sandbox if we move over to the right. We use ALSR and DEP and all these great things there. Control Flow Guard is new. That's all great, great stuff. It makes this very, very secure. Of course, there's other problems as well we have to focus on. And one of those problems, of course, was related to the plugins. So in Edge, we don't allow all the plugins that you're used to. And the reason why is these plugins on IE have proven to be a big problem. So if we look at the vectors of attack, and this is an old chart, so I'm just trying to get you to understand specifically kind of where the attacks and how they move around are. We saw a lot of stuff focusing on Java, right? People weren't patching Java, they weren't keeping it up to the date. And on IE, our data showed that well over half, it looks like it might be two-thirds of the attacks on 9/1/2014 were exploiting Java and owning the host through that. And then there was this day where we said, okay, let's no longer let people run old Java that's unpatched. And we introduced Java blocking, so if you weren't running pretty up-to-date Java code, we weren't gonna let it even run on the PC. And then what happened? The attackers were like, oh man, Java's all up-to-date. I need to focus on the weakest link now, which is not Java so much anymore. That's Flash, and then you just see Flash vuln exploits become the main topic, and now look at Java. Like, nobody's exploiting it in any measure. This is an old chart. I think we may see more now, but this is, again, just to kind of set the context that when we drop these bombs on the attackers, they just move somewhere else, and Flash was the big vulnerability thing. We all know that from the news. So we've done something pretty cool in the anniversary update to deal with Flash, and sadly, this thing built a little more fast than I wanted, sorry about that, but hopefully you didn't read it. So there's a couple things that we've done. turns out that Microsoft Edge and Flash both use this runtime called win32k.sys on the system, and this is a really, really old library on Windows. It's got some highly nuanced behavior, and some of that behavior can't really be changed because of app compatibility scenarios. And so some of this nuanced behavior is abused. Sometimes there's vulnerabilities that are very difficult for us to fix in an ideal way. And so we struggle with this binary. And sadly, Edge and Flash have full access to the entire set of interfaces. And this is a big one. This has, I don't know what the exact number is. I wish I had time to have gotten it for you. But this is a large one. Lots and lots of interfaces, lots of surface area for vulnerabilities and attack on it. And they had full access to it. Well, it turns out they don't need full access to that. They actually don't need access to almost all of that library. So why are we allowing it to contact that much of that library that's being abused so much? So what we did is we added a filter in between, and Edge can only access about 40% of the interfaces that it did before. So the tactic is let's just reduce the surface area of attack, so there's fewer places where they can find vulnerabilities and attack us, and then we do other things like isolation as well. But this is hugely, hugely impactful in kind of the number one gateway for browser breaches on Edge and IE. So that's hugely impactful. 60% fewer attack surface area. We did the exact same thing for Flash. Flash doesn't have as much access to this library anymore. So that's impactful. And then, of course, we have a very unique partnership with Adobe. Our engineers work hand in hand to help them design the most secure code, because this is an important thing. Adobe Flash is not going away. I know we read headlines on Engadget all the time saying it's going away. Well, people still want it, and they're still using it, and so we're making it more secure and isolating and doing all these great things. And then just to be super clear, Edge sits in a sandbox, but Flash is also in its own sandbox as well. Before, it was in proc. So if you found a Flash vulnerability, you went straight down to platform service and you own the host. Now it sits in its own app container, isolated away from everything. So you need a Flash vuln, you also need a sandbox vuln to escape. So this makes it really, really difficult on the attackers. Excuse me. And look at the impact that some of these things, these two things I just talked about are brand new. So these numbers reflect everything that precedes it. But you can see we're doing some great work here. In fact, I love the one in the middle there. I mean, it's always nice to talk about vuln counts, but it's the middle thing that really matters, right? If you have vulns that are not being exploited, right, you don't like the vulns, but that's the ideal, right? And that's kind of what we have happening, right? We've had a number of vulns happen in Edge, but none of them have been discovered and then exploited in toolkits on the web. right? So let me be really nuanced about what this means. It doesn't mean that some nation state didn't have a zero day and attack some organization like yours, and we didn't know about it. What we can say is we've never seen on the internet weaponized toolkits saying, hey, here's how you exploit this vulnerability on systems that may not be patched, because that's what always happens. Nation states use the vuln, and then it trickles out to a broader space, and everybody starts using it and building toolkits. We have not seen a toolkit that has allowed somebody to own edge in the wild, and that's a big deal. Nobody else has had that, so we're very proud of the progress there. That could change in the future, but that's why we have a new feature that we announced this morning that we'll talk about. Who here heard the keynote or has heard about Windows Defender Application Guard, just so I know? Okay, so a lot of you guys got out of bed this morning. That's good for you, but most of you have not. So I'm gonna show a video that maybe you've already seen if you've read the blog. It's gonna talk about this great new feature, which is a new isolation technology for applications. It's called Windows Defender Application Guard, and it's been built specifically in the short term to support Microsoft Edge.
The internet has completely changed the way we work and do business. It's hard to imagine a world without it. Today, attacks frequently target the browser, any browser, as a way to breach organizations and access their data. So it's critical that we make it a safe place. With Windows Defender Application Guard, we want to make your experiences just that, safe and secure. We're excited to show you this in Microsoft Edge. Websites that are considered untrustworthy by your business or enterprise will automatically launch Microsoft Edge in an isolated session. These sessions are visually different to ensure users understand they're in a more secure browsing environment. Enterprise administrators have full control to decide which sites the organization trusts and which launch protected with Application Guard. Our patented hardware virtualization technology extends beyond the kernel level, protecting your network from malware, viruses, vulnerabilities, and even zero-day attacks. This lightweight virtual machine isolates malicious activity coming from the web, preventing it from reaching the underlying operating system, apps, and data. If the user encounters malicious content, it's contained within Application Guard. The user can close this session without impacting their PC or network. So as your employees browse the web, Application Guard and Microsoft Edge keep your business network safe and secure.
All right, so I'm super excited about this feature because if you followed closely, this has huge implications, right? Basically, as you saw in the video, the user clicks on a link and let's say some malware tries to get installed, it's not getting installed on the host anymore. It might run in the background inside the container, but it's only there. So the malware can only impact that browser session. It doesn't have access to the system, it doesn't have access to other apps, it doesn't have access to your data, and it does not have access to your network, right? So imagine, right, you know, the browser's where we get all the malware, it's not gonna come outside of this container, in theory, right? We can't promise unbreakable, but this uses the same technology that we talked about earlier, right? There's a hypervisor that's isolating these two environments. We're using Intel technology, virtualization extensions to isolate these worlds. And so this is hugely impactful. Now, Windows Defender Application Guard, as I mentioned, is designed today for Microsoft Edge. This type of technology requires a ton of work. This is not something you can build very easily. But there is a roadmap futuristically to go into a broader range of apps. It's gonna take, to be super honest, it's gonna take time to get there. Our first release with Microsoft Edge is going to be positioned as something that's gonna be really best suited for high security environments, right? And the reason why is there are some friction points that this container in the moment will have. We'll resolve those as we iterate through Application Guard, but in the moment, we literally keep everything out inside that container. So imagine if you go to a website and you wanna bring down a document and you wanna save that locally, you can't do that. Now, here's the good news, right? Because that sounds awful, right? I can't bring content off the web anymore. That's why we have a feature that allows you to run Edge in a normal mode, the mode you're in today, and then you have a way to run it in the isolated mode. So you can set up a policy in your environment that says, hey, when I'm at any of my corporate websites, or I'm at my partner websites, or maybe even, you know, depending on your environment, maybe even say, hey, you know what, we kind of trust Facebook. And by the way, malware comes through there a lot of times. So I'm not sure I would do that. But some organizations will decide how tight they want this to be. So if you want it to be really locked down, right, you can say, hey, you know, we only have our corporate websites on that. If you want to be a little bit less locked down, maybe you include your partners a little bit less. So you can decide how secure you want it to be. And then you can kind of deal with the the gradient of like, hey, do I want to get in the way of my users or do I want to give them more flexibility, right? But imagine this. Imagine being able to say, hey, if my users search to some random website out there that we have no clue what it is, knowing that it's an application guard and knowing that nothing can come out of that is great. So, you know, consider putting news sites in the trusted list. You know, you decide for yourself what you want to do. Anyway, I just want to make the point that you can tune this to work well for your users. Super lockdown or a little bit less lockdown. As well, as one other thing mentioned, since this is running in a virtual machine, when you close the browser session, everything runs. So there's no persistence of anything inside the browser, right? So that's important. So why does it work so well? Well, it's because of what we talked about already, right? We're taking that system container technology and we've broadened it to be something for the app layer. And so Microsoft Edge being the first thing that can run in that space. Let me just do a quick check on the next slide. Okay, yeah. So before I get to the quick demo, I want to position another product out there, maybe others like it, so you understand. So we're isolating Microsoft Edge today. We're going to have to iterate that a couple times over the next year and change to make that as flexible so that you don't have to put so many things in the trust list. We can deal with the persistent challenge with time. Imagine a much better persistent story maybe later next year and maybe even 2018. But it'll be a little bit locked down initially. But there is another product to cover other browsers. We're only doing Microsoft Edge. So Bromium is a company that many of you have heard before. That's a technology that's very similar in concept to what we're doing. It's using micro virtualization. And there's a better together story. We have a partnership with Bromium, and we've been coordinating on this technology. And so I think it's very realistic for organizations like yours to use Application Guard with Microsoft Edge and to use Bromium for Chrome or maybe Firefox as an example. And maybe to use other apps. So these technologies can work together, and depending on your budget and the security requirements you have, you quite likely might want to run both. And we're talking with, you know, the government sector, a little bit interested in doing both. Private sector, you know, finance is interested, but smaller businesses find it economically difficult to kind of run both in parallel. But at any rate, let me show you a quick demo here. You probably saw this morning if you were at the keynote, but what we have here is a Windows 7 device running this is Internet Explorer on Windows 7, of course, and of course we have the firewall and Defender up because we're going to show how a vulnerability can result in the thing being exploited. So I'm going to go ahead and click on this link here, and the browser is going to run. There's an exploit that's run against a vulnerability, and of course you see that we've got the firewalls turned off and Defender's been turned off as well. Now, a real attacker is not going to do that. They're going to tamper with these systems so that they appear to be running when they're not, but we, of course, do this for dramatic effect. And, of course, if we are to go to the new mode, which is on Windows 10, where we're running Application Guard in Microsoft Edge, if I do that same thing, what you see is the browser loads, the exploit code runs as well. You'll see in the upper left-hand corner that, hey, I'm on an untrusted website, and, you know, it's kind of weird that we put our own site in there. We should have used something else, but it's hard to put somebody else's site in there and not have them complain about that. So we chose our own. Go ahead and add that to your trust list if you want. But at any rate, you'll see that it's clear that you're in this more secure mode. So the user is going to know that if they do something, they, you know, try to persist some data off, that, oh, the reason why I couldn't bring that data down is I'm running in this more secure mode. And the other thing you notice, too, is because this was fully isolated, even though the vulnerability breached the browser, the sandbox, and even the kernel of the Windows environment that's running in the container, they had no way to move laterally. They would have had to attack the hypervisor, or they would have had to do the firmware attack that we talked about earlier. That's going to be really hard to do. It's going to happen. We'll read about it in Black Hat, I'm sure, but it's going to not happen as often as what we see today. So this is a great, great feature. So let's switch back here. So browser isolation is huge. When you move into that space, I mean, if you think all the attacks you've experienced, if you're SecOps people, just try to assess in your head what that impact would be. I'll bet you it's you're thinking through, you're like, wow, that's probably most of the attacks we've encountered probably came through the browser. So this is going to be hugely impactful. But there are other pathways that apps, malicious apps, can come to the system. They can come through USBs, network connections, instant messaging software. There's all sorts of other pathways. And so Office 365 is going to do really well for your inbox. Application Guard, great for Edge. But then you have all the other pathways. And so what you need is another technology to complement it. And so the challenge we face when it comes to malware, excuse me, is PCs, whether it's Linux or whatever operating system, Windows. This isn't so true with Windows Phone and iOS, but on the desktop, what you find is these platforms are designed to trust any single piece of code that lands in the box. If a user gets a binary on the system is happy to run it, and of course, you have all sorts of defenses that are going to vet that to see if that's legitimate code that should be run on the box, but the PC itself trusts everything. And so that's an impossible model to solve against, because malware is literally forking by the second or a millisecond, right? We've seen websites that every new user that goes to the website gets a brand new instance of malware that is designed to defeat signature-based detection. And so there's just no way that we can use antivirus and signatures to detect everything, especially the new threats that we've never seen before, right? So there's not going to be a signature for that. And by the way, behavior monitoring, a lot of people talk about that as the solution. Well, guess what? They've changed their behaviors too. And you know, you might have some heuristics that make it helpful. Maybe you can detect a lot of stuff, but you know what? The smart people, they're going to find a way to work around the heuristics, guaranteed. So AV, you got to have it. It's not going to solve the problem, right? And so you need to move to a model where apps have to earn trust before they can be run. Windows Phone is in that model. It will not run anything that doesn't get signed and come from the Windows Store, right? Good defense. There's really hardly any malware that we've ever encountered. Some of it's entered into the store system, but not in any volume. And then iOS is in the same place, right? It's a really good story with iOS. It's because they, you know, sandboxing, gating apps in the ecosystem. That's the way you actually start to really actually try to solve that problem. Android, they've got way too many stores out there right now. I know they're working on that problem, but it's not as bad as the desktop type of scenario, but even Android faces some of the same challenges that PCs have because their ecosystem's too open for people to get software from anywhere they want. So we have a technology in Windows 10 that addresses this. I like to position it as next-generation app control. You'll understand why it's next-gen here in a second. And so Device Guard is a feature that is the successor to App Locker. So if you're familiar with App Locker, it's a allow, deny list type of technology. You create a list of things that are allowed to run, and then everything else is rejected. Or you do the opposite. You can say, these are the things that I don't want to run, and then everything else can run. Using a deny list approach is a loser. You may be able to stop BitTorrent from running your environment. It's not good for malware because you can't blacklist enough malware. Impossible. So you need to go with the allow list model, and Device Guard is like that. But what makes Device Guard better than App Locker, what makes it next gen, is two things. Number one is the way you can bypass App Locker or Bit9 or any of the other security software out there is if you can compromise the kernel or if you can elevate to admin privilege, you can start tampering with the allow lists of all these products, right? So these products are good at defending against that situation even happening, but it's not foolproof. And so we see cases where some app ends up running on, or maybe a vulnerability allows it to compromise the system. It turns off the app locker policy or changes it so it can run more malicious code, and then it's off to the races. So Bit9 and App Locker are susceptible to that. What Device Guard does differently is it has two things. One, the policy is signed. So what that means is you will sign the policy. So you'll create your allow list. You'll sign it with a digital signature in your environment. We have a website that allows you to sign it very easily. So you just sign up to our Windows Store for Business. You send up your policy file up there. We sign it. And then that policy then gets distributed to your endpoints or your management system. The kernel consumes it. And once it consumes it, the only thing that can undo it or change the policy is a new policy file that was signed by the same process, right? So this means an admin, a rogue admin, or a malicious piece of app code that's running as admin cannot undo the policy. And that makes us better than, I think, most of the technologies. Can't speak to all of them, but most of them are susceptible to admin bypass. But what about a kernel exploit? To exploit the kernel, the story is always you're totally in trouble. It's game over. We have a defense for that. As we talked about earlier, that code integrity feature that's running, it's really part of Device Guard that's running in the VBS environment, is making sure that everything in kernel mode is running with the highest level of security. It's compiled right. It's not created in a sloppy way, meaning it's allocating memory and removing that write flag, as we talk about. And so the ability to compromise a kernel is vastly diminished because it's running with every possible defense that's possible. And then the code integrity service won't allow any kernel mode code or software to run without being vetted by that service. So the combination of these things, signed policy and the kernel mode protection, which is kind of unique, except I think Knox has something, it's different, but it's, I think, kind of doing the same type of thing. This gives us, I think, the ability to say, hey, this is next generation. So device guard is something that you definitely should be prioritizing in your roadmap to delivering Windows 10. You don't have to do it right away. Get the platform out there. That's your first step. Then do credential guard, right? That's the next step to prevent pass the hash. Then maybe think about some of these other features later on. One other thing I want to mention is that we are committed to addressing the challenge of dealing with app control. So yeah, app control is hard because you have to create a list of safe apps. We've done one thing here in the anniversary update, and we'll do more things next year because we're going to make it easy. Our goal is to make app control brain dead for you and super easy. But our first step is not quite that far. Our first step is that now any app that you provision via SCCM, assuming you're using the latest version and you're using the anniversary update, will automatically add those apps to the safe list. So as long as you've got a good provisioning process, as long as the SCCM infrastructure hasn't been compromised, you're going to have safe apps coming through that system and they'll automatically be added. So for environments that really tightly control the apps in their environment and everything gets deployed through an image or through SCCM, device guard has become a lot more viable with the update that we just released. So let's talk about a backstop I wouldn't call it a backstop, that's the wrong way to position it. Let's talk about something that's complementary to device guard and super useful for customers who are not using device guard. So when you're running device guard, in theory, no arbitrary code is going to be able to run on the device, right? You bring in a malicious binary on a USB drive, device guard's not going to let it run because it's not signed by a trusted authority. So what use is antivirus in that scenario? Well, it doesn't need to remove, it doesn't need to detect and block anything anymore because device guard's going to do that. But what antivirus can do is it can remove malicious binaries that are effectively quarantined and can't run on your PC, and it can remove those binaries. So think of as Windows Defender is the solution that removes binaries that can't run on your PC because of device guard, but it can get them off of your endpoint. So good news there. So they are complementary, but of course Windows Defender is doing a lot less. For the organizations that are not using device guard or it's going to on their roadmap, but futuristically, Windows Defender is now a viable antivirus solution for enterprises. And maybe that's the wrong way of saying it. I mean, it's always been a solution. It's always been enterprise class. But the reality was is the competition was doing better than us. McAfee was scoring higher. Sophos scored higher. There's a bunch of other people. Bitdefender. People were doing a much better job than us on Windows 7 and the day we shipped Windows 8. Right before we shipped Windows 8, we made a conscious decision. Sadly, we couldn't impact the Windows 8 release of Windows Defender, but we made a decision to start building the team and building the practice around antivirus so that we could become a top competitor in the landscape. Our belief is customers are spending way too much on antivirus. It's not even really solving the problem. It's helping, but it's not really a great solution. It can never fix the problem. And so device guard's the way, but we know that not everybody can get to device guard, and so we need to deliver something that can lower the cost of ownership of Windows, and so we've decided to become a number one. As you see there in 2014, if you map that back to Windows 8, that's roughly when that shipped, you can see that our scores on 0 stars is what we were getting, so that was an F. Believe it or not, the stars don't reflect the protection. The protection was actually quite good. We were not the best, but we were not missing that much malware. We were just, compared to our peers, not catching as much, but we were getting scores in the 90%, sometimes in the 80% there. So we're getting a B if you want to think about it in those terms. But once we got the engine built up, we brought the team together and we started building our machine learning infrastructure, you see our scores have skyrocketed, right? And we have work to do. Right now we are in the middle of the pack. The middle of the pack is all fighting if you think about AV test. Is that AV test stars? Yeah, so AV test scores on a 0 to 100, I believe. We got a 98, we got a 99% on recent scores. New ones are coming out soon, and I can't wait to see what those are. But the point is, we're committed to being a number one. I can't promise we'll be number one. So let's finish up our discussion on post-breach. So when it comes to post-breach, there's really two things. Right, we have a scenario called conditional access, which is to deal with a post-breach scenario. Some people want to put conditional access in the first bucket. I like to put it in here in this post-breach because your PC is already owned. What we're trying to do is deal with the post-breach scenario. With conditional access, we want to prevent infected clients from accessing resources. So today, most organizations operate like this. Unhealthy PC says, hey, I need access to VPN VPN says no problem, you get in, and now malware's proliferating across your network. So huge, huge problem there, and I don't know too many organizations that actually use NAC and some of these other types of solutions. In fact, Microsoft had a solution called NAP, which we deprecated that did this. And we deprecated NAP not because we didn't believe in the concept. It was NAP was a dead end from a technology standpoint. We really needed the thing that I'm going to show you next. And so we need a world where devices are vetted before they're given access to resources. And so remember when we talked about the TPM earlier? And we talked about a feature very briefly called Measure Boot, which is taking measurements of all the boot components and all the drivers and all these things. We have all that information measured. We have it signed and sealed by the TPM. And now when you access a resource, those resources through Intune is an example. Intune can say, hey, you don't get access to email or the VPN unless you can prove to me that you are trustworthy, right? Because even though everything looks good, even though you're running Device Guard, I still don't trust you. So what we can do is take those measurements, send them up to the cloud. The cloud will then verify the package, make sure that it's signed by an authentic TPM and not a fraudulent one. And we have a list of all the real TPMs, and we use some interesting ways to differentiate between virtual TPMs that are hacks versus real TPMs that may be virtual TPMs or discrete or even firmware-based. But the cloud analyzes this package. It makes the determination, hey, it has integrity, signed, hasn't been tampered with, signed by a trustworthy TPM. It then signs the package. It sends it back to the client. The client sends it to Intune, and then Intune takes that package, cracks it open, and then it can start reasoning over this long list of data points within it. One of the data points it's going to look at is, hey, is secure boot on? If secure boot's turned off, pretty clear that a boot kit's running under Windows, and Windows is under its control. And so there's a lot of other types of checks they can do. They can check also antivirus, is it turned on? And you'll have to talk to the Intune to get the long litany of things that they actually check. But once the integrity of the PC has been determined, once other checks that the Intune and AirWatch, by the way, is doing this, and MobileIron's using this technology, they can make a determination where they can get access to resources. And so this is something that you'll want to think about. So let's talk about our last topic. I don't have a counter here. Oh, we've gone a few minutes late, but I can get through this real quick. Let's talk about, we've kind of talked about this first slide, so let me just get to the meat. So Windows Defender Advanced Threat Protection is a new offering that just shipped with the anniversary update. This is a really advanced, sophisticated product designed to compete with FireEye and the long list of other people in the threat intelligence space. What makes Windows Defender differentiated is a couple things. Deeply in Windows, we've built what effectively is going to feel like an airline flight data recorder. Every single action that happens on the PC, every process, every registry key that process touches, every file it creates, every other connection to other processes, everything that happens on that PC and every relationship between them are completely mapped out. So it's not just a long list of events. It's actually a set of events with detailed relationships between them. So we know exactly in kind of real time kind of what's happening on that box. So that's the first thing that's differentiated. I don't think the competition has anything like we have in terms of the ability and the optics we have on what's going on Windows. So that's something we're proud about. The next thing we do, of course, is we send that data up to the cloud, and this is where I think the real power happens. Our cloud, of course, consumes the data in your tenants. You're gonna have your own tenant in our cloud, obviously, for your company, so it's your data. Then we have machine learning that will use all sorts of heuristics and these types and do the machine learning thing to kind of understand, okay, are we seeing malicious, anomalous behavior on there? And that's constantly getting improved every day. Every week, the team that does the ML is meeting and improving these models. So Windows Defender Advanced Threat Protection gets better, in theory, every day or every week, at least every couple weeks, with new indicators of compromise that get baked into the ML system. And then we also couple that with something that we think is also differentiated, which is our human intelligence. We have the Microsoft security team. We call them hunters. They're assigned to specific adversary groups. So they're assigned to Strontium and Neuroblaze and all the other people, Syrian Army. They track their behavior. They understand their tactics because that's what their job is. And they, when they understand those tactics, they build models for that. They build IOCs for that. And they're looking at your data as well to see what's going on. And then, of course, we have Alert Console, as you can see there, that will let you know when things have gone south in your organization, when you've experienced a very sophisticated targeted breach, probably using some sort of vulnerability that's maybe probably a zero day in many cases, assuming you're patching your environment well. These alerts in this console are coupled with threat intelligence, meaning, you know, hey, here's who the adversary is, here's the type of things you can do to remediate from this situation, here's all the things that going on in your environment, or here's the other PCs that may be impacted. And so let's quickly switch to a demo of it. Here's the ATP console, and you'll see it looks very similar to some of the other consoles, which is a good thing. So you're probably familiar with it from Ops Manager and other things. So you'll see here we have an alert, one high severity alert, and when I click on that, I get a list of all those new alerts. This one has been attributed to a very specific actor. The NeuroBlaze adversarial group is the people who are doing this. And if we click in, we can learn more about what the attack is. And we can also get the recommended actions. So we have some of the threat intelligence information you would expect. And we have this thing called the incident graph. So we're looking at the specific alert on the specific machine, and we can see all the processes that are related to the attack. And we also can see that this installer also reached out to another machine that also has the same binary. So we can actually see from our graph here what's going on the entire network, all the machines. And then if we want to drill into this specific machine, we can see all the litany of activities, right? I mentioned that we have this flight data recorder that's recording everything. You can see all the activities that's going on. It goes pages and pages and pages, and your SecOps team will appreciate all the fidelity they have. But if we were to click on this particular one here, oops. Let me go back here. Sorry about that. Let's see here. There we go. We can see these are the specific activities that gave our cloud the signature of the NeuroBlaze adversarial group. We know that that pattern of behavior here, the tool that they brought down, it may be named differently every time that it comes down to the endpoint, but the hash value of that binary, we know that, right? We know that they rename it to obfuscate themselves, but we know the hash of that. So we recognize that binary. We recognize that that binary always goes straight to PowerShell, installs some more garbage, and then runs a bunch of other tools on the system to promote and perpetuate the attack. And so this gives you kind of the optics you need to detect and respond to the most advanced threats that you'll experience on your network. And so with that, we just did the demo. With that, when you net all this out, it's no surprise that, you know, the Pentagon, Department of Defense are moving faster than anybody else in the world other than Microsoft to Windows 10. I know that's kind of a market statement, but here's something I'd like to mention. So I was in the meeting with the State Department. I meet with DoD constantly. And they said, if you deliver Credential Guard, which we didn't cover in detail here, but Credential Guard's our feature that stops past the hash. They said, if you deliver Credential Guard, which is based on this Hyper-V isolation technology, if you deliver that in Windows 10, that's the only feature we need to justify moving off of Windows 7. Just that one feature. And I've given you a list of other things. Device Guard, ATP, this new browser feature, the impact there is huge. And so there are so many reasons to move to 10. It's not surprising that DoD is moving so quickly. So there you have it. We've covered threat resistance, hopefully you've learned a few things. And so thank you very much for attending. I love seeing a great audience like yourselves. And so if there's any questions you have, I'd be happy to take those now. Thank you. Doesn't look like there's microphones up, so if you want to come close to the stage and ask the question so I can hear it, I'll repeat it. Hi, how you doing?
We are not on virtual desktops, APIs,
yeah.
And also servers.
Thank you.
With virtual machines.
Yep, you'll need to turn on, it looks like. I think I know where the question going is.
Yeah.
There you go. Go ahead and ask it.
All right. We have a lot of virtual machines that we want to protect, and we want to use this Credential Guard.
Yeah.
Currently, we're using VMware as a hypervisor platform.
Yeah.
And you cannot run Hyper-V on top on a virtual machine on VMware.
On VMware. Yep,
yeah.
That's true.
So does that disable this, or is it impossible for VMware to make it possible, or for Microsoft to make it possible, or will it be?
I can answer that question. This is a great question. I should have mentioned that actually during my presentation, but there was too much content. So the question is, Great. I understand that virtualization-based security is going to help solve a bunch of problems, but what about my servers? What about VMware, Citrix, all these other things? How do those all work together? And so we have a story there. Let's just talk about Microsoft Stack. With Server 2016, if you want to run VMs that are using virtualization-based security for the browser, for CredGuard, DeviceGuard, all on top of Hyper-V, it's all good to go. We got that covered with Server 2016, so you need to run on that platform. So that's good news. What if we're running Citrix? Well, we've worked with Citrix, and we believe we're still doing some ongoing discussion. We believe the outcome when we finalize everything will be that Citrix will recommend that you run Hyper-V as the hypervisor rather than the Xen component. They will monetize, of course, their product through the management of VMs, but they're not going to run their code at the bottom of the stack. So we believe that's where the end game is with Citrix. And we're optimistic that that's going to be the outcome. So you'll be able to run Hyper-V just like Server 2016. It'll require Server 2016, and then you can manage that environment with the Citrix management tools. What about VMware? With VMware, we're just starting discussions. And so we've got work to do to find out what they will do. An option for them, this is an option for Citrix, and there may be cases where Citrix wants to do this, they can run Xen on the bottom of the stack, and they can support, and I say they underline, they can choose to support running our hypervisor on top of theirs. They will need to do the work in theirs to make it all go. We will not be testing this ourselves. They will have to provide all the promises of supportability of that. We don't know any reasons why it wouldn't work, but that's something that the third party would have to solve. So it's going to happen. Which road we take with VMware is a little bit unknown. The one with Citrix, more understood. Question.
I was going to ask about Kerberos tickets, if that's going to be in Credential Guard, and if you see Kerberos, the lifetime growing then with this or going away because of Credential Guard.
So the question is, like, because of Credential Guard, would we increase the lifetime since they can't be stolen?
To Credential Guard. Are you going to be putting service-granting tickets into Credential Guard, the memory space?
Yeah, you know, this is a good question. I'd have to sit down and talk to engineering about the scenario and see, so I'm sorry I don't have one. You know, our booth, we've brought a lot of the engineering team actually to Ignite this year, more than ever. Yogesh Mehta, he owns that area. He's my counterpart on the engineering side. I'm on the product management side. He'll be able to give you an answer to that question for sure.
I have a question on performance.
Of course.
As we go and virtualize more and more stuff and you get different virtual machines running on the same platform, what would that do to audio quality and link or other things?
I mean, what would it do to audio quality?
Yeah, the performance implications of running multiple operating systems is something that's not just, you know, a developer thing, but a general thing for everybody.
Yeah, so this is a good question. So the question is, when you run all these virtualized technologies, what happens to performance? When you run the system container, there's almost no implications because what we're doing in that case is we're just moving code out of Windows and moving it to another environment. There's a little micro kernel there. Maybe micro is not the right word. It's another kernel that's much smaller running in parallel. So there is impact, but we believe it's negligible performance impact on a modern PC. If you start running Edge in a full, it's running in a full instance of Windows almost, right? And it's running, and then you will notice some performance implications. The way we've design the boot process. We're going to boot that VM in parallel during boot. So the experience of the user is once they're at the desktop, it's going to be super fast. There's I can't remember the exact number, a millisecond level gap in performance between running it native and in the container, so like your users aren't going to really notice it, and the browsing experience will be very good. Now, running video and these types of things within that container, there's still some work going on there. We're going to be working with there were some people from Intel here earlier. It looks like they left. But anyway, we're working with Intel on some of that. And I don't know if we need new hardware or if we just need some work in software. My guess is we'll probably need a combination of both. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But you will be able to render video. You might not want to watch. It's not going to have the fidelity that you're used to.
I'm actually more concerned with your link session running on your main OS. What happens to that when you do context switching between operating systems to, you know, serve the Edge containerized one and the audio quality on the link on the other OS? Not necessarily audio within that OS, even though that's a different question. What happens if you have two different operating systems trying to tie into your microphone and speaker and all kind of other stuff? That's even
One step, the hypervisor to help with that. But these are good questions. And so, you know, like I said, the application guard, a little more limited and pretty good, but there's some limitations. I think those are things that we'll get as we move down the roadmap.
Thank you.
Any more questions? Right over here. Yeah.
Yeah, I just wondered if you could speak to what's required, like the things that you showed here. Mm-hmm. Could you speak to like how much of this is in the EMS bundle? And then also, do you need an enterprise licensing agreement for Windows 10, like the subscription? So could you maybe speak to run all the things that you set up here?
Yep.
Talk to what products you actually need to get to run all
right.
this.
So none of these features are tied directly to EMS, which, you know, you can get it as part of EMS, but you don't have to be an EMS customer to get access to this. As long as you have the ability to license Windows Enterprise Edition, you can have everything that we talked about today. The features that will require Enterprise Edition, just so you know, will be Credential Guard. Basically, all our virtualization-based security technologies are all in the Enterprise Edition of Windows. Now, in the past, Enterprise Edition was a little bit hard to procure depending on the size of the organization, and so we've actually made it really simple. So it's actually available via a number of other channels. I'm not the sales person, so I don't know exactly how to articulate how much easier it is, but what we wanted to do is we wanted to create the condition where small, medium-sized businesses, which had no relationship with our field, could procure it, and that's now possible. So it's enterprise is something we're going to see a lot of people adopting all across the gamut of enterprise, all the way to the small side. Yes. So everything that we've talked about today is also in the education edition. I don't know the exact strategy for education in the moment. I believe that they're in lockstep in terms of they are in lockstep in terms of security. That I can tell you. Other features, I'm not sure if there's any differentiation.
Just a quick question. How will these features run in VDI type environments?
Okay.
Virtualized also?
So how would they run in a VDI environment? So if you're running a full Hyper-V stack, it's going to run great. Now, is the gentleman from Intel mentioned a moment ago, video streaming in the Edge browser when you're in a container, there could be some implications there. I don't have the answer on perf and what that looks like yet. I know there have been discussions that there may be some implications there, so I don't have a good answer for you today since we just announced it. But that's something that we're working on improving, and sadly I don't know if, is it a hiccup or is it a big challenge? I just don't know at this point. So it's going to work good in a VDI type of scenario.
Yeah, with Defender ATP.
Yes.
How do I get access to that portal, and how do my devices get assigned to my ID that accesses that portal?
Right. So to be really clear about ATP, ATP is actually the one feature that is above and beyond Enterprise Edition, just to be super clear. Okay. So we have something that we call E3, so all the virtualization technology is there. One feature that's in the thing that we call E5 is ATP, so it's an add-on above and beyond, kind of like MDOP was. So that's the way you access it, is to subscribe to this. Of course, it's a console-based system, and so you'll provision policy down to the endpoint that will then say, hey, here's where my tenant is, here's how to access it, here's the credentials we use so we can connect. So there's a policy-driven way. I'll probably direct you to Heike Ritter to talk about how that policy gets provisioned. Does it come through Intune, SCCM? I'm sure the answer is both, but I'm just not 100% certain on the Intune side, so Heike can give you the full answer there.
Do I have to have all of the Windows Defender features turned on to use the Windows Defender App Guard with Microsoft Edge, like the AV components?
That's a great question. Actually, you can run it completely independently, so which is a good thing. Windows Defender is a brand name that, if you haven't noticed, we're expanding it to be things that are completely not connected with antivirus. We will see, but my hope is that we will rebrand Windows Defender the antivirus as Windows Defender Antivirus, to make it more clear that these are standalone things that can be worked individually rather than all under one umbrella. So the umbrella will be a brand rather than an actual feature, futuristically.
So what is the destiny of a user account control, UAC, compared to like device guard? And using like prompting for username and password on the secure desktop?
So make sure I understand. So what's the future of like UAC? Where's it? What are we going with that?
Yeah, where are you going with UAC? Because I know it hasn't been touched within about probably like one or two versions of your OS.
Yeah. So I don't expect we'll make many changes at all to UAC, other than maybe like Windows Hello integration, these types of things. That may even be there already. I'd have to double check.
It is. Yeah.
Is it?
Is,
okay.
Is it
good.
Is it worthwhile to keep on or to crank up all the way to the top setting to prompt with username and password on secure desktop versus just prompt for consent or?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, there's, you know, the more you ratchet up, the higher security level is.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, as far as UAC, what we're trying to do is we're trying to eliminate the world where even UAC even exists, right? It's really, it's a solution that's kind of ugly for a problem we can't fix, which is Win32, unless we fully isolate everything in containers, and so, like, futuristically, maybe we can get away in that context, but that's like a long ways away. But as long as there's Win32 running on the desktop, we need UAC to gate admin access when something shouldn't have it, for instance. Now, when you move into the universal app world, you'll notice that UAC is no longer applicable. And why is that? Well, it's because the app sits in a sandbox, and the app runs with zero privilege. It doesn't even have your privilege. The only way that Microsoft Word in the container gets access to a document is when you file open. It doesn't have access to the file system, whereas today Microsoft Word has full access to the entire file system, right? So with universal apps, you provision access in real time as you use them, and for that reason, because they run with no privilege and can't access arbitrary stuff on your PC, we don't need UAC as a backstop like we do on Win32. So I don't think we'll improve it at all, except to keep up to date with authentication things for the prompt.
So as an alternative, if you don't use UAC and you were to go to deny all with device guard, are you seeing big deployments with Device Guard, or is it feasible in a large enterprise? Or
Let me think here. So let me think about. I'm trying to think. Are there any scenarios where UAC might be useful on a legitimate app? I mean, I guess
you use it. You know, think about either evaluating UAC or Device Guard, just denying everything from running. So then there's no way that foreign apps can run without without either being signed or having by user permission or user opt-in.
Yeah. So here's where you would possibly need it. So let's say Device Guard has a signature that says, I'm kind of making this up on the fly, so I may be flawed in my thinking here, but so let's say Device Guard has a signature for, let's say Adobe. Adobe installs a thing called installer.exe, and then that thing runs and it needs to elevate to install more code. Device Guard would allow it to run because it's signed by something we trust, but it's now elevating and wanting to install new binaries on the PC, and that we would probably want to flag. And so you can either suppress that, as you talked about, or you can allow the prompt to happen, and my security guy is saying, yeah, we should probably allow people to say, hey, but you could argue maybe you don't need anymore because only trusted code can run. So maybe,
I'm
not 100% certain. My feeling, based on now that I've talked this through in my head, is maybe you could turn those things off.
So
I don't recommend
seeing,
it yet, but you could, in theory, do it because only trusted code can run.
Are you seeing large-scale deployments of Device Guard? Is it actually being adopted in the enterprise space, or?
Well, everybody's interested in it because app control is kind of hard.
SCCM integration would be pretty key.
Well, we're going to see it ramp.
Yeah.
But I don't think you're going to see it ramp to the highest level until maybe later next year when we deliver some more stuff. What I can tell you is we're running it at Microsoft on all our privileged access workstations. In fact, if you have an IT workstation that accesses any data center, you should be using our PAWS solution. If you don't know what PAWS is, privileged access workstation, you should be running that. You should be running Device Guard on that, because if your IT workstation gets owned, if you're not using strong auth, it's game over for your data center. So that's a place where it's being adopted at Microsoft. Everybody's using Device Guard on IT workstations. We just had our first major deployment. It's just starting to roll out now. And I can't disclose the customer, but I can tell you that's going to be almost 10,000 PCs. There are other smaller pockets, but when you can get a customer to do 10,000 PCs in a major organization, it says, hey, that signals that other people can do it too. So,
can I ask you one more quick one?
Sure.
Internally at Microsoft, do you use the local admin password solution to manage all your local admin accounts in your credentials, or how do you manage that space?
I actually don't know. There's a session on Wednesday where MSIT's partner, which is basically like a VP, Dustin Engels.
Yeah.
Go see his session.
I'm attending that, yeah.
Yeah, I just got done building his deck, actually.
Okay.
He's going to present that. We've been collaborating on that, and he probably can answer that question, although that is a little bit detailed, but Dustin seems to know everything, it seems, so give him an ask.
I'll be there. Thank you.
All right, sounds good. How are we doing on time? Just to make sure that we do good. I'll take questions until they kick me out.
Okay, so my question is, now that Defender is able to be deployed at enterprise scale on, like, for antivirus, are we seeing any large-scale deployments with that as of yet?
Yeah, just checking my time just to make sure I don't miss something next. I got plenty of time, so this is good. So the question is, are there any other large-scale deployments of Windows Defender?
Because I know, I know, you know, customers now are, you know, they're looking to save money on licensing, say, with some of the other vendors. And if it's built in and it's, you know, comparable or even better, you know, is there marketing that's taking place to let our customers know that?
Not at this point. So what I can tell you is there are a lot of customers using the previous version. They're using System Center Endpoint Protection with the Windows 7 version. So we have lots of large-scale ones there. We don't have as many as we'd like, but they're there. Now that we have the numbers, we're seeing a lot of interest. And I can tell you that we have, for instance, we have people in the financial sector who are using third-party stuff that are actually doing POCs right now. I can name two. I can't give you the names, but I know two in the top 10 financial institutions. In automotive, one of the biggest car manufacturers in the world is doing a POC as well. So we've finally gotten to the point where we can actually start having people start investigating. So we have some existing ones, but those are people who, you know, arguably said, hey, you know, it was good enough before. For people who want a higher bar, we're just starting to see the evidence that the interest is there and they're testing it right now. Yeah.
Quick question on Credential Guard.
Sure.
Not sure if you're familiar with Evil Maid or Remote Butler.
The Evil Maid attacks?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So would Credential Guard protect you against credential cache poisoning?
Thanks. Credential cache poisoning. So give me a little more information on that particular attack.
So Evil Maid is basically setting up a, basically fooling a workstation to talk to a domain controller that thinks it's its own domain, but it's actually a rogue DC. Resetting the password and account and updating your cache credentials on that workstation.
So they're receiving
they're basically
a fake
the secure
MTL
channel between the workstation and the domain controller. You're updating that user's password on the domain controller, receiving that password, and then poisoning the credential cache on the workstation.
Okay. Well, you know, I need to drill into this a little bit more. The Credential Guard is not going to prevent the first part where they're changing the user's password, right? Because Credential Guard has nothing to do with the that side of the I always think of authentication as two things. You authenticate with some something, a password, smart card, Windows Hello, and then you receive an access token, which is like your single sign-on thing. The thing you receive from the DC, this NTLM hash or your curb ticket, those things would come from the DC. And if a fake DC handed you some fake NTLM hash, like what could you do with that?
So I didn't know if there was any additional checks.
Yeah, I'd say these attacks are like completely different. What we're worried about with CredGuard is somebody basically compromising the kernel or running as admin on like with Mimikatz and dumping the secrets out of the kernel, which are actually could be your password, by the way, on Windows 7. But on Windows 10, we block that. And then the NTLM hash string, which is, you know, just a string of text. Those are sitting inside a lockbox, and so the only thing that comes out of the lockbox is an encrypted version of that that's useless to an attacker.
So on TechNet, Credential Guard said it protected Kerberos tickets as well as NTLM version 1, but it didn't say NTLM version 2.
It protects against version 2. That's too bad the docs are wrong on
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it just said V1.
Yeah, okay. I'll try to remember that and get the doc team to fix that because, yeah,
Thank
it's
you.
A solution for NTLM full stop. Mm.
Hey, Chris, we have time for one more.
I guess I'm the one more.
Okay, Hi, you Chris. Won. Congratulations.
So can you speak again about your description regarding AppLocker? Because it sort of implied like, well, AppLocker's being headed out to pasture with regards to Device Guard kind of picking up the slack.
Yep.
I sort of feel like it's a good Better Together story, but I don't want to put words in your mouth. I'd kind of like to hear your articulation.
Yeah, great question. So here's kind of, I'll give you the inside the locker room story. So when we decided to build an improved app control system for Windows 10, the fastest path to get there was to build a new technology. It was going to be too hard in that moment to morph AppLocker to do the things we needed to Device Guard. The goal, though, And that goal will not happen early next year. So we have a release that everybody's heard about. We're going to do something H1 next year. That convergence of these technologies will not be complete at that time. Hopefully it happens in the release that follows. But our goal is to bring them under one roof. And how that looks in the end, you know, the engineering hasn't inspected out. But we don't want to set AppLocker out to pasture. I think what we'll say is AppLocker no longer exists as a brand. DeviceGuard provides all the features it used to have, plus all the scenarios that it doesn't currently do that are AppLocker related. And you can manage it in the same way through group policy, and you'll have all the cool wizards and stuff like that. So think of it as being converged and not, we won't leave you hanging on that one. Exactly, exactly. So what I'll do is, since they're kicking me out, next speaker needs to come in. I'm going to pack up my PC, and I'll go out this door here on the left. So if there's more questions, I can take those until you guys are finished with me. All right?